Hey everyone, this is John, and this is the Nintendo Show, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet. This is going to be the official show for the month of March 2024, and I am not technically by myself. Sherlock is here, but also there is a segment in the middle of the show coming up here where me and Ryan are going to talk about some of the new releases, Unicorn Overlord, Contra, Operation Galaga, and Princess Peach Showtime in particular. But before I get to that, I did want to go through some of the news and new announcements. So let's get things started. As we usually do on the official show, let's start with some headlines. A very sad happy trails to Akira Toriyama. He passed away earlier this month. May he rest in peace. One of the most influential writers, authors, artists, not only of this decade, this century, but this millennia. Really sad to see him go. And he has an incredible legacy that he leaves behind. Star Ocean 2 is getting an update that is going to add a harder difficulty mode, new boss raids, and some new art assets. That is a really cool game. There's a really cool reason to pick this one up if you have not already. I really, really liked this remake of Star Ocean 2. Really good. And finally, the last headline that we got, there are some contract assignments for some people who do work for Nintendo that are ending, and Nintendo is not going to be renewing these contracts. This news sort of comes at the tail end of a lot of other publishers, developers announcing a lot of layoffs. And while these are not technically layoffs, it's contracts for contract workers that are expiring, that aren't being renewed, it effectively serves as laying off employees. And I'm not sure if we know what exactly these contract workers were doing, if they were doing like game testing or maybe some marketing. That's typically the sort of thing where Nintendo like will hire contract workers, this sort of thing. And like Nintendo has said that they're going to hire some people on as full-time employees. They haven't really said how much. And I think it's something like 100 people who are going to be losing work because these contracts are ending. And this is like further evidence that contract work is fucking bullshit. And nobody should be allowed to hire people on a contract basis. Like people should, like if you need employees, hire them on as employees. And if you run out of work for them to do, fucking find more work for them to do. Like it is super shitty for people to be losing jobs, losing work because they were considered contract workers who were effectively doing the same things as full-time employees. It is super, super shitty that these type of practices are being used by Nintendo and other companies out there. People who are employed in this sort of gig contract work should not tolerate this type of shit. Like it's either a real job or fucking move on and remember that all of the power lies within labor through solidarity. We do have some new game announcements. Raynatus was announced. I forget who the developer of this one is, but this is an interesting looking sort of action RPG. It reminded me a lot of Nier Automata when I was watching some gameplay. Like this really fluid action-based combat where it looks like it's emphasizing things like parries and dodges to engage in this real-time action-based combat. I think like RPG is a term that gets thrown around a little too often. I think this was sort of like pitched as an action RPG, but it's an action game. All of the combat is in real time. And I'm sure that there are things like level ups and skill trees and that sort of shit, but I don't think that's what makes a game an RPG. But it's an interesting looking one. It's got a really nice like modern art style to it. A lot of like the things that they showed were like in I think Akihabara, Japan. There's sort of an area influenced by that urban area. Also, RPG Maker With was announced for Switch. I think that one is out later this year. I've always been interested in these RPG makers. They look like they give you a pretty wide tool set to use to sort of make your own role-playing game. But I've always been curious. I've never really quite worked out how it is that it lets you manipulate or build a battle system. Because for me, that would be the make or break thing. Also, the amount of time it takes to actually build out these RPGs would be a big factor if I were going to engage with this or not. Corpse Party 2 was announced for Switch. That one is coming out this fall. Corpse Party was a game that I never played, but was always interested in. So, I don't know. Maybe someday I'll get around to playing those games. But there is a really interesting game called Akatori that was announced for Switch. That one's TBD. No release window for that one. But it's just a pixel art side-scrolling action game where the sword is that you're using it for your melee combat is also part of the platforming that you do. For example, you don't inherently have a wall jump, but if you throw your sword into the wall, it then becomes a platform on the wall because it's sitting out of the wall perpendicular to the wall. So you jump on it and then you jump onto the next platform. Or the sword like looks like it could be used as like a pogo stick at certain points. And I think it's really interesting of a mechanic to have your sword play more for just combat, to actually have a role in the platform, in the locomotion of the game. That one is definitely one worth keeping an eye out, in my opinion. We got some release date updates. Luigi's Mansion 3 got a released date for May the 23rd, a lot sooner than I expected. I thought that this game might be like somewhere in the middle of summer, but no, that one is right in the middle of spring releasing. Shin Megami Tensei Vengeance actually got moved up. That one was coming out on June of the 21st. It's now coming out a week earlier on June the 14th. That's the same day as Monster Hunter Stories. That was a game. It's a remake or a port, maybe an HD up-res of the 3DS Monster Hunter Stories game. The sequel to this, Monster Hunter Stories 2, released on Switch a couple years back and did pretty well for itself. So they're bringing over this one on June the 14th. Paper Mario the Thousand Year Door is coming out on June the 27th. Another really surprising release date. I didn't expect we'd see this one till the fall, but we are getting it right at the beginning of summer. A really cool game. Actually, Mika was playing through the GameCube version of the GameCube setup in the spare room again. She was playing through that for a little bit the other day before she got distracted by Super Smash Bros. Melee, as we all do. But really cool game. Super excited for that one. And then Trails Through Daybreak got a release date for it, July the 5th. Really quick, before I get to the new releases, quick gospel or gossip, just one round. There's a lot of rumors/leak confirmation sort of things going around. Right now there's been no official announcement, but it's pretty much saying that Persona 3 Reload is coming to Switch 2. I'm going to call gospel on this one. Even if these leaks, rumors, miscommunications turn out to, you know, not be based in reality, I think it is a given that that game will eventually end up on a future Nintendo platform. Persona 3 is definitely going to be coming to the next Nintendo system. Count on it. So for the new releases, Ryan and I are going to pivot over to a couple of different games. We're going to talk about Unicorn Overlord, Contra, and Princess Peach in just a second here. But real quick, before we get into that, just need to mention that Double Blind came out on March the 14th. That is a sort of like a card-based visual novel kind of thing. That one was featured in Nintendo Direct a while back. It's a neat-looking game, but probably one that I won't have time for. The Star Wars Battlefront collection also came out on the same day, March the 14th. Anime Girls, Son of a Beach came out on March the 14th. The only reason I was in here is I wanted Wes to read a description of it, and Wes is not here. So, maybe next time. MLB The Show came out on the 15th. You want to play as the Dodgers or the Royals. Those are the teams to play as. Legend of Legacy got an HD remaster on March the 22nd. South Park Snow Day, which is a game, maybe we can finally stop talking about that one, is out on March 26th. And Pepper Grinder came out just a couple of days ago at time of recording. I have not played that one yet, but I do have it queued up to play in a couple of weeks, so I will report back on that one in the mini show. It looks really, really cool. I've been excited for this one for a long time, and from what I'm seeing, it doesn't really take all that long to beat, which is nice. It'll be nice to have a nice brisk game after all of the long games that I've been playing throughout most of the year. And finally, before I get to the main event here, there were a few games added to the Nintendo Switch Online on March 10th, Mario Day. They added Mario Golf and Mario Tennis for the Game Boy Color to the Nintendo Switch Online app, and they also added Dr. Mario, the Game Boy version, so the worst possible version, to the Nintendo Switch Online app, and F-Zero Maximum Velocity just recently was added to the Game Boy Advance collection. So, pretty cool. But without further ado, me and Ryan are going to talk some Unicorn Overlord. Hey everyone, this is John.
And this is Ryan.
And this is the Nintendo Show, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet. This is some kind of show. We're going to talk about Unicorn Overlord and Princess Peach. That's what this show is.
Yeah.
Why don't we just jump right into it? Ryan, how far are you in Unicorn Overlord? Have you finished it yet?
I have not. No, I have not finished it yet.
Nor have I.
I am almost done with the northernmost place, ice.
Hell yeah.
The cold area up there. I'd probably be further along, but I got kind of sidetracked with some stuff in the game, where I started going through the Colosseum.
Nice.
So, I went through that, and I actually ended up, the whole point is that there you can unlock a really powerful character in it, and I've now done that.
Oh, shit, nice.
Yeah, it's I wouldn't call it a cheese build, but I was able to get through it, in a manner where... clearly the Amelia character is far more powerful than I would have been if not for basically having kind of set up sort of a trap to take advantage of her weaknesses.
So when you're actually going through the Colosseum, I'm in the top 10, but I kind of like do it in chunks. Like, okay, I've achieved this level, so let's kind of like fight the people who are in the same level as I am. My characters are sort of topping out as of earlier today. Highest level is like 36, maybe 37. And then the lower level ones that in parties that I'm currently using anyway are like 34, 35. So I'm keeping a lot of characters clustered together. And I'm in the top 10 at the Colosseum. But in any of the fights that I've been through so far, you don't actually have to even defeat all the enemy characters. You just have to like win the fight, which means like you end with more HP than they do. Is that true of the final fight as well?
I mean, that's essentially it. Yeah, you don't have to KO your opponent. You basically just have to win in an advantageous manner. Just have to have, as I understand, if you lose 0 hit points and your opponent loses 1, you win the fight.
Yep.
That's really all it takes. That's what's considered the margin of victory. And it's also not really like... I mean, my total character level is lower than yours. Like, my highest strength units are in the 34, 35 range. So I'm kind of playing to the level I am.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not over leveling. I've got 9 full teams of 5.
Nice.
That I'm playing with, and I've pretty much upgraded every character that I need to. And it was actually, there was some trickery involved in it. Like, I actually beat, I beat her basically by using a level 2 thief, literally a level 2 thief.
Very good.
A Viking, simply for the fact that it can cast something called Warcry.
Yep.
And then also just, I'm not sure what you call them. I think her, I'm trying to think of the character's name. They're the women with like the big mallets.
Oh, sure.
Kitra, I think, might be her name.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I had Kitra in there. And then the long story short is Warcry helps it so that your thief can basically sit there and evade all the attacks. The thief can also steal all of the PP, the blue crystal action turn stuff.
Yeah, you're sort of like your passive stuff.
Yeah, and then I'm relying on the hammer woman to just basically swing in, and I equip them all in very specific ways to make sure that, one, they don't lose a lot of health, because they are going to take hits, they're going to actually take some damage, that in the end that they just essentially dealt out about 100 damage to her and her 450 HP health pool, and only took maybe 50, maybe 60 damage.
So, that's a victory.
And that was enough to get the win. As I understand, you can do this with just literally... There are ways to do it with literally one character.
Mm.
So I probably did more than I needed to actually get the win. But you it's actually, I wish there were more fights like it, honestly, because these really do make you tinker with builds. And they make you kind of like patchwork, come up with ideas and think about them differently, because, you know, you can always just sort of hit the plus key to optimize, and it just takes whatever the best inventory is, whatever the most productive way of building out, of loading out a character, it'll do it. And that works very, very well. But then also there's some really clever stuff you can get away with if you really take the time to sit down and, you know, work on how you're going to make a character like really shine and really stand out.
So what difficulty level are you playing on?
There's like four difficulties. Yeah. I think I'm on the third.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's called tactical, which is definitely the way to do it, in my opinion. Especially like like us, we've played a lot of these tactical games before. We know what we're doing. Because one thing I've heard on a lot of other podcasts, specifically like RPG focused podcasts, is people talk about the game and talk about like, oh, it's really easy. I'm having a really easy time with it. And like the one podcast in particular I was listening to, it was like one guy was saying like, yeah, I've played for 15, 20 hours and I'm almost at the end. And then invariably, whenever like this conversation ends, everyone's like, oh yeah, I'm playing on normal mode, which is the issue there. Like if you're looking for like an actual experience where you have to do things like think about the parties that you're building and the characters that you're using, you should put it on tactical mode. Because the way it's set up, if memory serves correctly, when they did the demo, the tactical difficulty in the full version was the sort of default. And they got some complaints about it being a bit too challenging. So they sort of slotted in another difficulty level at like the very bottom and called that like casual mode or story mode or something like that. Then they made what was the easiest mode in the demo normal, in quotes, and then tactical, and then whatever the hardest difficulty level is, which, you know, I haven't had any particular fight where I'm like, oh my god, how am I going to get through this? I don't think I've had to restart all that many fights, except if I'm doing like a side mission where, or like what are these, like the portals to those missions where you can just like grind up characters and get more of like those tactical books to boost up your experience. If I'm looking to level up just specific characters, I'll start the mission with those characters out, and if it's going sideways, I'll just restart it and kind of keep them more toward the back and find other ways to grind them up. But like any of like the main missions or anything, like as long as you're paying attention to where your units are going and who's doing your best damage against what enemy, you're gonna make it through.
Yeah, I find somebody playing this game in a 15-hour runtime absurd.
Yeah,
like what are you even accomplishing if that's what you're doing? Like, I mean, and admittedly, maybe I might be overdoing it. I think my runtime, my save state says I've been at it for 40 hours.
Nice,
which sounds about right. Honestly, that I feel like I've. None of that's just been, the game's been idling. I mean, I feel like I've really plugged a ton of time into it. And yeah, and again, and I am keeping this giant roster of characters kind of all at the same level, but I also swap them around a lot. And, you know, like you're saying, those side missions that you get that are replayable are fantastic for bringing characters up. And literally, once you beat it the first time, the second time through is a lot easier.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what I do is I have three different teams I deploy, all of which are led by some kind of flyer. And I put them all together, cast a hasten call on all of them, and then just have them go straight towards the nearest artillery.
Yep.
And then whoever has the lowest level, I put in the artillery and I let them just churn experience. And then at that point, if I want to, I bring in a lane, and then whatever of those battle points you acquire, royal order everybody, and get their experience pumping. Like, you know, that's, and again, a lot, not a lot of tactics really in that. It's, I think that's a fairly, you know, mind off way to casually level a whole team, do it quickly. You get those treaties like you're talking about. You also, everyone that's stationed in a building, returns a unit, returns a, whatever, like if it's like a fish, it'll get a fish. If it's a rock, it'll get a rock for you. So you just do that, and you're not only are that, you're getting all of those resources that then you can then turn in for deliveries to get more honors, to upgrade your characters, expand your rosters, like, you know.
That's
I feel like that, yeah.
It's something that I've sort of been obsessively doing is trying to have someone stationed at every town just to keep on churning those resources to then turn into, you know, a little bit of gold and some honors to then churn into recruiting more characters to station at the rest of the towns that I'm in. I'm doing it like the wrong way. Like, if all I'm really concerned about is the resources, you just like hire the cheapest soldiers and just station them in the towns. But I'm like being obsessive about like, no, in the elven area, I want all elf units to be stationed in the towns. And in the wintry area, I want all beast people stationed in the different towns. And they cost so much more than just like your little grunt recruit that you can get earlier in the game. But I like doing it. Nice. Also, like, I haven't really done anything where, you know, you use the item to boost your experience, or you like use the royal order to boost your experience. I haven't really engaged that a whole lot, and it really is a much more effective way to boost the amount of experience you're getting rather than just churning missions over and over again. I should actually pay more attention to that.
And I think it's more fun that way to do it, where you do have a character that's kind of under leveled. Like, all of the characters I was bringing up, I mean, everyone's kind of in a good spot. I probably have some that are in the lower 30s. But they'll all, you know, they all will level up together very, very well. And I don't find... And even if a character does die on a squad, like, they still get a good chunk of experience.
Yeah.
Like, they still get... I think it's just halves the experience. And on top of that, you can also... I mean, if you really cared about it that much, you could throw on all of those experience-boosting items onto their characters themselves. But, like, I don't think that's necessary, I find. And again, you've got those treaties. Like, I'm sitting on stacks of... I don't know. It said I had 99 of, like, one of them, and I don't know if it capped at 99 or I just happened to have 99 at that moment, but I had done it enough where I had 99 of those fucking things, which is, like, more than enough. And that's, like, the expert level one. That's the one that triples it at level up to level 30. So, like, I can pretty much bring any character along right now if I needed to. But I don't know. Like, do you have any standout units you particularly are fond of? Any ones you really like to play with?
Well, let's see. I have a couple of different... I have two elf parties that each have, you know, like, you have, like, two elf girls that are introduced to the storyline. They're both using those spears. Yeah. They each have one of them. They each have an elf fencer, an elf swords person, and two elven archers. And I really like those units. Just as a minor spoiler, but just in the way of, like, if you're planning on building units going forward, in the final area, the Western continent, there is a blacksmith. And the blacksmith for one, I think it's called a ferrite or something. There's like a special material that's really rare that you get. But you give him one of those and 50 honors, and he'll take any piece of equipment and like max out its attack power. Like, it seems like all of the like the swords and the spears and those things in the game, like their max physical attack is like 25. So if you there's a character who has a weapon on them where you really like the effect, but it's kind of a weaker weapon, you can always bring it over to him, max out its attack for a few materials, and then it changes like the way that you're able to use that equipment. It takes something that's got a cool effect but kind of useless and turns into a really cool weapon. But so I have the two party of elves, and I've done a little bit of work on their weapons because again, cool effects, but they're not particularly strong. I have I call them the best friends, and they're kind of your starting characters, like Lex and Elaine and Chloe and Scarlet, and Joseph just rejoined the party because they were the last party that I actually maxed out to five members because they were doing so well on their own. So they're all one unit together, and it'd be really fun if you actually name your different parties. And then I call them like the desert punks because they are a lot of the characters, the sort of seedy characters that you met in the desert. Actually, what the guy, the gladiator you met early on in the game, who is associated with some of the people who live in the desert, he's in that party. There's also
Bruno, I think.
He's not Bruno because he's the gladiator, and I hardly ever use that guy. It's funny that I remember his name more than this other guy's. He was the house Carl that you get early on.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I like him a lot. Yeah. Aubyn. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Aubyn's really good.
And he's in there with Jeremy and another sellsword guy and one of, like, the... his sister who's got, like, the big shield and the crossbow. I forget what those characters are called. And also a Dark Knight is in that party as well. And I like them a lot. I have a party. I still am running with a party that's just, like, your big wall soldier guy and three mages behind him, because that's just so efficient.
He's awesome, and he's just sort of this perfect glue guy, and he has a lot of things that, like, you know, every there are some where it's like every time he just blocks an attack he gets an extra AP. Yep. It's like it's kind of absurd.
Yep. And I have a party that's got some Griffin Knights in it, and then I got a party that's Virginia, and then like the two Gilbert and Prim and Minerva. She's the Wyvern Knight. That's mm-hmm. been a really good party. And I really like the dive valor skill that she can use, just to kind of like get you up into somebody's face really quickly and do some big damage and take them out.
Mm-hmm.
How about you?
Yeah. I was seeing a really neat build with a Wyvern Knight recently that they were doing where it's basically an attack that can hit everyone, but you can arrange it such that your lead member of your party can have that white cat ear thing.
Oh, yeah.
And what it'll do if they have enough AP to do it is that instead of it... Because it's sort of like... it's like in Pokemon, compared to Pokemon, it's like Solar Beam. You know, Solar Beam like takes a turn to charge up and then it lets it out.
Yeah.
So it basically does that all at once. It's like it's basically like having this unit does Sunny Day, or having that hat on another ally turns it into a Sunny Day, to where it instantly takes effect. And if you put initiative on it too, it basically means that she's going to just nuke, like before anybody does anything, she's going to nuke the entire crowd.
Nice.
You know, and it's pretty delightful. And because it's also one of those ones where you don't see a lot of, like some of them have very obvious counters. It just seems like it's a big AOE damage that just hits the entire board. So very, very cool. Like for me though, like yeah, on my nine teams, I've got basically two that are dedicated cavalry units mm-hmm. that have yep. at least two cavalry units. Almost all of mine are backed either by some kind of mage or striker, or a healing unit, maybe something like a bishop or
a sainted knight.
Yeah, that kind of thing. I have Lex running his own squad, which is just kind of a fun one. I have him with Travis, with the main archer, with a recruited wizard, and with a shaman. And it's just a really just all-purpose Swiss Army knife where it does really consistent damage. Impossible to bring this team down.
I'm actually kind of surprised that they don't like give you more like actual mages within the game. Like you, like
yeah,
pretty much
yeah.
only
had to...
two that they give you like that are part of like the story progression.
Yeah, I have three different teams that are fronted by a griffin, or by the what is her name, Achilles, the Feather Sword.
Oh yeah.
And she kind of operates the same way. I've got Aubyn on a team with whatever his name is, Hodrick, the main legionnaire, the big tanky dude mm-hmm. you were just talking about. And then I've got the most recent squad I built out was centered around Amelia, the character that you get from the Colosseum, and she just like fucks things up. Oh my god. And then the background of that is basically a lot more of the snow characters. Yeah, like most of my teams have a diversity of characters. I don't use a lot of super specialized things. So yeah, like like characters like what is it? How do you say her name? Baron Jaria?
Oh yeah.
The Dark Marquis. Oh my god.
She's great.
She is just an incredible character. Trying to think of who else. You mentioned them already. The Elven Sibyls.
Uh-huh.
Etalind or whatever, and then Rosalind, I think, is the other one. The this the Swordmaster type. What is it? Melisandre? the really horny one that's like obsessed with the main guy.
Oh yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, she is fantastic. Like the shamans and wizards are great. I mean, I don't really see too many weak links throughout it. The only ones that honestly feel a little bit like weak links are just the archers. Like archers have a very specific, I mean, anything that shoots a bow, right? I mean, they have very specific units and they're good for support stuff, but unless you really spec a team around keeping them safe, they're kind of a liability and they don't do all that much in my opinion.
Yeah, of course I have like some elven archers in the back of my elf parties. And they're useful because they're actually dealing magic damage rather than physical damage. But then like
then there's like the hunters and the arbalists, yeah. And again, it's always good to have one just in case, because you need to be able to hit something in the air if it's up in the air, of course, but you know, other than that, they kind of come up a little bit lacking, mm-hmm. especially when anything's got a decent front line.
Yeah, and I have it set up to the only other archers I have are like the one of the archers you get early on, and then another archer that you get he's like kind of paired with this thief guy that you get in the southern forest, the elf area. They just kind of give you these two, like thief and archer, in that area for some reason. But mm-hmm. I have those two paired up with Travis, Berengina, and Rolf, I think it might be his name. Like, so there are two archers in the back, and then two thieves and Berengina up in front. So mm-hmm. yeah, they're basically back there, like in case I run into a flyer or just to do support, because like Travis and Berengina can just do so much of the heavy lifting on their own, because she has attacks that do more damage to people afflicted with status ailments, and she also has an ability to pick up AP when she takes out units. So they're just kind of there to, in case I need to put someone up in a watchtower and rain down some arrows.
Yeah,
but most of the time, like they're just being the cheerleaders at the back of the party there.
Mm-hmm. I found a good use of the sniper's amber lens,
yeah.
Which is just purchasable from a shop. Uh-huh. It's not like a special item. You just get and buy it from a shop in the northern part. I hope I find more, because what it does is it grants true strike and critical hit. So I have this paired up on one of my Griffin Riders, who's also set to simply use this, the base high swing attack, uh-huh. and a Warcry belt, and support another attack support from another character on it. So basically, oh, and I loaded her up with a Raven Plume as well to increase her initiative. Mm-hmm. So again, it's one of those things where she starts the turn, pumps herself up like crazy, hits herself with a guaranteed crit and a guaranteed true strike, no matter what's in front of me, and then comes in with a high swing and hits everything.
Nice.
You could have three thieves in the front row, or three cell swords, or three anything with high evasion, and they're all fucking done.
Mm. That's good thinking, because like, yeah. Like you're saying, like I run into a thief, like a party that's got a couple of thieves, and I'm like, oh my god, fuck. All right, now I have to bring out some sort of archer unit. But, mm-hmm. like, well, yeah, what you're saying, to get some a true strike on there. That's handy.
Oh, yeah. So I don't know. This game's so much fun to tinker with. You know, it's a game that you can... yeah, I'm sure you can blast through this thing in 20 hours, but it's, like, it's the same as someone being like, oh, yeah, I got Mario Wonder and I beat it in 8 hours. And it's like, well, what'd you accomplish in that? Did you... Yeah.
Why would you?
It's not about the end. It's about it's not the destination. It's the journey.
Like,
you know?
It reminds me of like there are times where I have to tell Mika, like, slow down when you're eating. Are you even tasting what you're shoving into your face? Because there are times where like she's like not even done chewing and trying to shove more food in your mouth. Like you're not even. What are you doing? You're not. How do you even know what you're shoving in there anymore?
Yeah, this game is not about what's the fewest number of turns somebody can win a chess match in. It's thinking about how much fun strategy you can have with a knight and a rook and three pawns on a board.
Yep.
You know, it's thinking about how you're going to use them tactically.
And they do
it's tremendous fun.
Like yeah. A lot of the times, like this is a damn near, if not completely perfect game. There are times when As I'm moving forward in the game, I'm kind of thinking, okay, I've been kind of using the same unit setups for a long time now. And the battles aren't necessarily getting more complex. They're just getting bigger. But then, like, the game is so perfectly well-balanced that even if you're just faced with a bigger battle, you do have to think about what you're deploying, because you still have a limited amount that you can deploy right away. So you have to think about, like, okay, well, what am I going to put on the battlefield first? And it's always an important decision. Like, early on in the game, when you get, like, those small side missions where you're, like, right next to it, you're pretty much just a couple of fights and you're done. You're right next to the goal. You can just deploy your favorite stuff and probably get through it. But when, like, it's a more sprawled out map and you have multiple objectives and you have to decide who's going where, despite how many different fights they're throwing at you, there's always, like, something that, like, if you didn't think about it enough, it's going to surprise you with something like, oh, wait, I messed this up. Let me recover really quick enough to reassess.
Oh yeah, and if your first few fights are not wins in your favor, you're not getting more, you know, resource to put out more units. Like if you lose your first couple battles, you might as well just start over.
Yeah,
like that is a big component of it, is that you can't just be like, who are my most underleveled units? Let's throw them out there and see how they do. It's like if you kind of really need to have a game plan.
Yep. Anything else about this game that we need to address?
Have you proposed to anyone yet? Are you gonna?
No, not yet. Not yet.
Who do you think captured your heart? Is it Travis? Is it Clive?
I mean, I do like a thief. I'm not sure. I probably should make a decision pretty quick because I'm getting toward the end of the game. But yeah. It's like the equipment that you get from it, like, is such a big advantage. I don't know if I want it to be like combine like the ring of the unicorn and the ring of the maiden in the same party, like have both those characters in the party, if I want to split it up. So a lot of it depends on, like, okay, well, how am I going to build out the rest of this party and who's going to be where? But yeah, how about you? Did you?
Oh no, I have not yet. I think it is really funny. It is enjoyable to get into some of the little side story arcs, because it seems like a lot of the matchmaking has basically been done for you in the game already. It seems like there are certain couples that are just sort of meant to be together.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could go off course, but you could probably just end up with, you know, the one that you're most likely supposed to end up with.
You're standing there, like, at the decision thing, and like, oh, Scarlett, you're here too. Chloe, hang on, no, I'm giving it to you instead.
Yeah. Which is like, I mean, sure, it sucks if that is supposed to be another pair in the game, but you know what? I bet you what happens. It just means Scarlet's now available. So somebody at the end of the day is getting Scarlet. And it'll work out well, I imagine, for all involved.
But yeah, I mean, what a tremendous game. 10 out of 10.
Yeah. I think it's just kind of absurd that it took 20 whatever years for someone to make a truly fitting successor to Ogre Battle, and I think they've done a great job. And not to say that this is exclusively an Ogre Battle game. There's a ton of Fire Emblem in this series too. A lot of Final Fantasy Tactics. I can, you know, very much see that. But yeah, this is very much a love letter to Ogre Battle.
That was something that I wanted to ask you about, because we've mentioned Ogre Battle a couple of times comparing to this game. Did Ogre Battle have like that pervasive overworld that this one does? Or is it more of like a map to map?
At least the Ogre Battles that I played, the earlier ones, were like a series of, I think, and it was absurd, like 40 or 50 missions that you would play through. And they would be, again, like you're talking about, to that scale where you would have, you know, 6 to 8 bases in one map you need to capture. Mm-hmm. Like the fights would take a very, very long time.
Yeah.
But no, there wasn't really an overworld. I think you kind of went through zone to zone. And I think, I don't want to get this wrong, but if I remember correctly, once you actually beat one, it sort of became a town, not that you would travel to in an overworld sense, but it would have a town that would have recruits and inventory shop that you could trade at, you know. So you would beat a level and get more stuff to tinker with on your builds and stuff like that.
Okay.
that's how they kind of kept the influx of characters and items in the game.
Well, really quick about Contra, because I've played through Contra Operation Galuga a few times now.
Yeah, like the remake, I guess, is essentially it.
I think so, like a remake or a reimagining. It's not like a total remake, because in the original Contra, I remember there are some like missions where you're inside a base and it's sort of like a behind-the-back shooter, which is really impressive what they pulled off on the NES there. But the missions in Operation Galuga are exclusively like side-scrolling missions. Some of them are like auto-scrollers, like you're on a bike, like you would see in Contra 3. But there's no like behind the back in the fort missions. There are no like top-down missions like you see in Contra 3. And I think like the missions are all just a little bit too long. There's 8 missions in total, and I think it would have really benefited from like trimming some sections out and tightening up a little bit. And also would have really benefited from having some mission variety to it. There are certain missions, especially when you get to the end, it feels very much out of Contra 3 because you're like inside the alien and shooting like the swarms of enemies that are coming at you. There's also some very directly out of Contra 3 stuff, like the enemies that, like when you're climbing along the rails in, was it the second or third mission in Contra 3, and like the flying enemies are coming over to like scoop you up and drag you off. Those are back in there, and like they'll give you a flamethrower right in front of that area so you can roast them as you go. So I think that it would have been really nice to see some mission variety, maybe a couple of other missions, but shorter, like have all the missions be shorter, kind of chop them up a little bit more, to make it just run a little bit brisker. I also think that it's a little bit of this, like if there's a spectrum between Contra and Metal Slug, it's not like in the middle of that. It leans more toward Contra, but it's a little bit more Metal Slug than I was expecting, in that like it knows that it's giving you like it's giving you a lot of like inescapable situations, especially during some boss fights. It's kind of just surprise you with things out of nowhere. And like if you're playing the game over and over again, you might be able to like find the positions or the movements that you need to do in order to get through it. But a lot of times it feels like I'm just like waiting for the next death so that I can sort of like recalibrate, get a weapon and continue firing at it. There are a couple of like cool upgrades that you can get. So like when you're playing through the game, when you first start, you can kind of like select your passive skills. And some of them are like you can choose to have an HP bar, or you can choose to play one hit kill. I would always play with an HP bar because there's just so much happening in the game. You can choose to like add a couple of segments onto your HP bar to give you a couple of extra hits. You can choose to start every level with a weapon already equipped, and you can choose which weapon that is. Nice. You can also, I've mentioned before, the upgrade system. So if you grab a spread gun, it will shoot 3 bullets out. And if you grab a second spread gun, it will stack on that and then shoot the 5 bullets out. And every weapon has that stackable effect. And one of the things that the game does is really nice is that if you have like a flamethrower in your first slot and a spread gun in your second slot, and you grab another spread gun, it won't then split it up and say you have 2 spread guns, one in each slot. It will stack it on the thing you already have. So you're not like losing a weapon. And if you have like the flamethrower equipped and nothing in your second slot, your second weapon slot, and you pick up a laser, it will then just dump it automatically into your second slot. So it lets you keep moving more rather than having to think about, okay, do I need to switch my weapon? Should I keep this and ditch the other one? And it's really friendly about just putting the weapon where it makes sense for it to go. But there's a passive skill that you can equip when you start the game that I really like. And it just like starts weapons automatically upgraded to their second level. So there's no fussing over, like, okay, I have 1 homing bullet. Do I have another one? You can kind of cheese this a little bit too. So
When you take damage, your weapon will get downgraded. So if you have the level 2 weapon, it'll get downgraded to a level 1. If you have like the level 2 homing gun and you get hit, drops down to a level 1. But then if like there's another weapon nearby and you pick it up and it drops your homing gun, you can then just pick up your homing gun again. It'll be automatically upgraded to level 2.
Oh, okay. Nice. That's good.
Yeah, so there's fun little ways you can cheese. And, like, overall, I think it's a pretty good version of Contra, but like I'm saying, it takes just slightly too long to do a full run-through. And it'd just be nice if there was, like, a level where you were playing from a different perspective. But other than that, like, they did an update. The game runs smoother now. I'm not having as many issues. There are some things about some of the levels, like stage hazard kind of things. You know, you see them in a lot of video games where, like, the ceiling's going to smash down. If you don't duck in the right place, you're going to take damage. They do some stage hazard stuff like that I'm not too particularly fond of. I think it kind of gets in the way of just the run and gun stuff that you're looking for out of Contra. But, you know, this is definitely, like, a step in the right direction for the franchise, and hopefully that they're able to keep this going and not fuck it up like they did with Rogue Core a couple years back. But yeah, overall, I'm generally positive on it.
Nice. Yeah, next time we get together, we'll have to do some couch co-op.
Hell yeah. Oh, and there's I wonder how it's going to run, but there's up to 4-player couch co-op, so Wes has no excuse. He's got to get in on this
one. Yeah, he's got to.
And then the last game that I've been playing is Princess Peach Showtime. And we were talking a little bit about this one really briefly before we started recording. It's a game where I'm slowly playing through it. I'm playing a couple levels every day. It is level-based, and there's a sort of like level select that you can go through, so you can kind of pick and choose. Each level will have a different like costume theme to it. So you'll know when you start this one, you're going to be playing as Cowgirl Peach or Mermaid Peach. So you'll have a general idea of the things you're going to be doing. All the levels have all like different collectibles for doing different things or like finding little hidden areas. So there's some replayability in the levels if you want to go back and 100% it. When you do replay a level, none of like the little cutscenes or dialogues can be sped up or skipped. So you're going to be watching the same things that you just saw before. And this game does skew younger. Mika, who is 10, has really been liking it. She is just as far, if not further, than I am at this point. She actually played it when I first got it. She played it before I did, and she sat and played it for 2 hours uninterrupted. So she really got into it, which is cool. And it's a good thing that she got into it because, you know, if she wasn't getting a lot out of it, then I might be thinking, I spent $60 on this, and I'm not getting all that much out of it. I could have spent that $60 on a second copy of Unicorn Overlord, and that would have been worth it. But yeah, because it skews younger, you know, obviously the kids are going to get more out of it. I don't want to like sound too critical of the game because it's made for children. Some video games are made for children. It's okay that they exist. I think overall, I think it's good that it has a variety of levels and gives the kids different things to do on every level. All of the different costumes or power-ups that Peach has do significantly different things, and I think that's a good thing. It is kind of funny though, like playing video games for so long, we sort of have an understanding of the language of video games. Mika started playing it, and there's a thief Peach, and who like has a grappling hook and can swing onto things. And when you first get the costume, you are like down at the bottom of the floor, and there's like a vertical wall going up. And I had not played the level, but Mika was playing it, and she was like playing my Switch in handheld mode. And he's like, "Dad, I don't know what to do at this point." And I took the Switch, like, "All right, let me take a look." And I grabbed the Switch, and I was like, "Oh, you got to do a wall jump." He's like, "What's a wall jump?" I'm like, "Oh, well, if you do this along the wall, you hobby wrap." She's like, "Oh, I didn't know you could do that." I'm like, that's what happens when you've been playing video games for 35 years.
That's really funny. Yeah, there is a lot of stuff that, like, is it's all video game logic. It's like barrels.
Yeah.
It's like, if you see a barrel, it's like, that thing is going to blow the fuck up.
It sure is. But yeah, there's, like, 10 different costumes through it. And, like, the game is sort of structured where each costume has, like, an introduction level, a second level, and then the sort of, like, mastery boss fight level associated with that costume that you unlock after beating the first two. And then there's a sort of, like, extra boss fight stages after you beat 4, maybe 5 individual stages. It'll then, like, introduce you to, like, the boss of that general area. Then it'll open up a new zone that has different levels into it. The coins you can collect to purchase different types of dresses, like, the different patterns on them. You can also buy different color schemes for your little sunflower glowing star buddy. But yeah, I mean, overall, like, the game runs pretty well. There are actually some things in the game that there are like some auto-scrolling parts, like, particularly when you're Cowgirl Peach, where you're, like, flipping lanes on your auto-scrolling section where you're riding this horse. And there are collectibles that, you know, aren't super difficult to get, but you have to, like, be pretty quick and be, like, looking ahead to see which lane you want to flip to and when you're timing your jumps in order to get all these collectibles, which probably offers a pretty good level of challenge for kids. Like, there are a couple of times where, like, oh, I missed that one. Let me just find a way to die real quick so I can start this section over so I can get that collectible. There was a point where I was thinking, I'll just 100% this game. It's not too difficult. Let me see what happens, like, if you get any sort of special award for 100%ing it. And then it introduced this cooking power-up, which is fine. But, like, in order to get the award, like, all of the awards for that level, you have to be really efficient with your cooking skills. And there are a lot of cutscenes or dialogue in that particular level, and I didn't want to replay it, so that's when I decided I'm not going to 100% this game. But yeah, generally pretty good. Good one for the kids.
Okay. Yeah, I see it's made by Goodfeel. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they've been pretty busy for Nintendo recently. They did the Epic Yarn, and they did the Yoshi's Crafted World.
Yeah, I generally like the stuff that they do. Like you were saying, like the Woolly World and Crafted World and Epic Yarn and all that. Those are games, like, Epic Yarn, I think, is one that's pretty well remembered, but, like, the Yoshi games, I think, are a little bit underrated by people who generally review video games. I think those games are pretty good, and a lot of times they kind of get dismissed as, like, oh, this is a kind of, like, easy stuff for kids. And, like, they are, like, games that skew younger, but I think, like, if you're actually trying to get all, like, the collectibles and stuff in those games, they offer a good amount of challenge.
I also can't quite tell what this is, but they've got, I'm guessing this is a Japan-only action platformer. Otogi Katsugi Mameda Nobaku? I have no idea how to say
that. Yeah, this. That's sorry, probably a Japan-only.
Yeah. That's fine. That's what they've been up to. Yeah. I mean, again, this looked really interesting, and they had a great trailer, but to hear you describe it, you know, and saying that it is more of a kid's game, it's hard to justify, like, you know, for me, like an audience of me, to like purchase it for $60,
yeah,
that seems a bit much. If like you're saying, I could just borrow it from you and check it out, I'd be happy to. Though this does look like a lot of fun.
Yeah, I can borrow a copy, and if you know you play the first four levels and are still in, then you could finish it and not have to spend the $50.
Do you have a favorite outfit?
I like the way Cowgirl Peach functions. I think that's They give you like some fun, interesting things to do, because her primary way of like interacting with the world is with a lasso. So there's a lot of like pick stuff up and throw it in order to interact or engage in combat and things like that. And there's also, like I was saying, a lot of those auto-scrolling sections where you're riding a horse. There's a part where you got to like fight a train, which is pretty cool. I like the sort of like general Western aesthetic. I like I've only played one level, but there's like the superhero, like the Power Ranger Peach, which is a pretty fun section to go through. Mm-hmm. Other than that, like the best outfit, Mika really liked the figure skater. I thought that one was okay. Yeah, I think the cowgirl is probably the best one.
Yeah. Not Ninja Peach. Mighty Peach.
Ninja Peach is good. Mighty Peach is the Power Ranger one.
That is okay.
Yeah, I heard the official name is Mighty Peach.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, solid game. Mm-hmm. Anything else we need to address before we close it out here?
Opening day?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. I actually watched a baseball game.
Oh, yeah. Which one did you watch?
The Rangers played the Cubs.
Okay.
It was an extra innings thriller on which the Rangers won.
What was the final score?
Oh, I don't even remember. A low-scoring game. I want to say maybe like 3-2. Something like that. Apparently they again, I don't follow baseball, but the Rangers did pick up a rookie named Wyatt Langford, who came from the Florida Gators.
Okay.
And he's there, I think, left fielder, and I mean, again, a sample size of like two games, but he's played he's been very productive on offense. So, you know, good for him.
Hell yeah.
Normally it's not like I know some sports very quickly transition collegiate athletes or, you know, younger amateur athletes into pros. Mm-hmm. I know baseball tends to take a while.
Yeah.
Tends to take a while, especially for position players to really kind of cement themselves in rosters.
Yeah, it's tough, especially going from college into the pros, especially if you play a lot of college ball, because then you're in your early 20s and getting a minor league contract. You know, you think like a player that is good in college would kind of fast track up to higher levels of minor league ball. And hopefully that is the case. Hopefully, like, if you're committed to playing for a college and then enter the draft in, you know, your 19, 20, 21 age season, you know, you're hopefully going to be able to move up the ranks a little bit quicker. Not always the case, because there are teams that like to, you know, manipulate your service time is what they call it. So after you spend a certain amount of games in the majors, you're entitled to, you know, moving up faster. Or you're entitled to a faster track into years where you're going to become a free agent. And they like to manipulate that time to keep you from getting free agency longer. And hopefully, like, that sort of stuff is able to be worked out and put a stop to, as, you know, the Players Association continue to negotiate, you know, terms of contracts and things like that. Because it is pretty shitty to do that to someone's career. And, like, it seems to be, to me, self-defeating, because it's becoming a younger person's game. It's been difficult for players over the age of 35, even like players who are over the age of 33, to have security, like secure contracts to keep on playing, even though they're still productive players. There were players who, you know, at the season is starting, who were yet unsigned, who are like legitimate, like major league players. They would make a lot of teams better, but mm-hmm. There's a lot more value placed on like the young prospects than there is on, you know, proven major league players. It's very strange. So it's weird to, like, there are teams that try to stash younger players in their minor league systems longer, but then once they, like, reach age 30, they're like, no, we don't even want you on the team anymore. So, like, you're like prepping them to play between the years 26 to 30, and then you're going to discard them. Like, either commit to a youth movement or commit to players past their age 30. Season. It seems like they give people such a small window in order to perform at a major league level. But anyway, the Red Sox, they won the first game of the season. They won 6-4 against the Mariners on the road. Good win. They lost yesterday 1-0. Nick Pivetta was really, really good. Struck out 10. Offense couldn't get anything going, which is unfortunate. I don't have particularly high expectations for this season. I think that if they turned in a winning record, that would be really, really great.
Yeah. Well, that's tough. And yeah, I think it's been, you know, it probably feels longer ago than it really was when the last time they won a title. Wasn't it just like 2019? 2018?
22. I mean,
yeah, it wasn't that long ago. But yeah,
a lot of teams wallow in misery for decades before they're able to win a World Series. And, you know, I don't want to take that for granted. I would like to see them return to a more competitive form for a consistent amount of years, because they won in 2018, awful in 2019. 2020 didn't matter for obvious reasons. 2021, they were good. But then, like, the past couple years after that, they've been basement dwellers.
Yeah, that's not great. And I think I don't remember the exact numbers, but I do know that, yeah, like, going in last season, the AL East was just an absolutely brutal division to be in. There were so many good teams in that division.
And, you know, it's still the case where the AL East is very good. When we'll see how things work out for the Yankees. It did not seem like they could pitch, which is kind of like the Red Sox, what was supposed to be the Red Sox problem, even though they had a couple of really good pitching performances so far from their starting pitchers. Hopefully that continues. But like the Orioles got better. The Orioles looked to be very, very good. The Rays lost Wander Franco because it turns out that he's a big old creep who creeps on underage girls. We may never see him in the major leagues again, and they like locked him up to a long-term deal. He was like going to be their guy for a long time now. So they're probably not better than they were last year just because of that. But they, you know, they always find a way to be competitive. So I don't think they're going to suck. I don't think the Blue Jays did much to make themselves better. They signed Joey Votto as sort of like it seems like it's going to be like a farewell tour. He's going to be retiring, and he's from Canada. They signed, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, who was an ineffective player for the Yankees. So they went ahead and decided to bring him on. I don't think they did.
That is a name right there. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa?
Yeah. Kiner-Falefa. He's got the dual last names.
That sounds like it's North America, South America, and Europe all three at the same time.
It's true. He's a man of indeterminable ethnicity by name. But like the Rays are going to be worse, but still probably competitive. The Blue Jays aren't going to be any better and might end up being a little bit worse than they were last year. The Yankees, you know, it's hard to imagine that they'll be worse than they were last year. They were barely above 500. But we can hope. We can hope that they're going to be terrible. But the Red Sox didn't really do anything to make themselves more competitive. They kind of like stood pat. They're hoping that some of their young guys will carry them forward, and maybe they're waiting to strike next year. But it kind of, for several years now, they seem to be directionless. They don't really know what sort of team that they want to build. They're just kind of throwing things together and seeing what sticks. But they're 1-1. They're on pace to go 160-2. They can do it.
Yeah. Hopefully they can get to 81-79 or whatever it is. 83-79.
Yeah. Just barely break through. But yeah.
Anything else you want to talk about? I don't know.
I don't think so.
Have you heard of X-Men 97?
I have heard of X-Men 97. I have not watched any of it yet because before, like, I thought I was going to be able to churn through all of the animated series from 92 before 97 came out, and it didn't work out that way. So I actually just before we started recording, me and Mika finished the final episode of season 4. So I just got season 5 of the animated series to work through before I start 97. And season 5 is like 10 episodes.
Oh, I didn't know you were watching the original run again all the way through. Yep. I've only watched one episode of the new series. And it's authentic. It looks and feels just like it. It was confused. I didn't hear any press about this when I just saw it on Disney Plus and started it up and wanted to check it out, because I thought maybe they had remastered some old episodes or something, and I was like, oh my god, no, this is a new a new series. It's very faithful to the art style and like the. Even like the low frame count, I guess is how you would call it. The animation feels a little chunky, you know, because there's I guess a lot of those like in between animations aren't there. But yeah, it's good. Yeah, it's really good. I like it. It's kind of a very mature adult. It's very similar to the series you're watching. So
yeah, it is a really ambitious animated series, especially for 1992, and the way like it did like have a more serious tone than other animated shows that were on that were its contemporaries. I think it's interesting because like as you get further into the series, your sort of your mainstays for every episode, it's Wolverine, Rogue, and Beast. And like Xavier is in there a lot too. And a lot of your other characters kind of get sidetracked. They'll get their own episode every once in a while, but like you hardly ever see Storm. And eventually you hardly ever see Jubilee either, which I'm a fan of. Don't need to see any more of her. But the sort of like the things that happen in every episode is Wolverine has his catchphrases. He'll say, "I can smell him," at some point in every episode. And he'll always threaten to murder somebody. And in every episode, he'll like whip out his claws and say, "Okay, I'm going to kill you now." And it's just wild. It's interesting to watch because I'm sure like 9, 10, 11-year-old me was like, "Yeah, Mr. Stabby Hands, he's awesome and he's mean and he's harsh. He's cool. I like him." But now, like, looking back, like, you fucking psychopath. Like, there's an episode, like, do you remember the episode with Nightcrawler where they find Nightcrawler and he's a monk in Germany because he's a man of God? Like, Wolverine full on, like, went to go stab him through the chest with his claws. No questions asked. Just, yep, time to murder this guy who's blue. And the only reason Nightcrawler lives is he teleports away. Wolverine didn't know he could teleport. He just attempted to murder Kurt. It's fucked up.
Yeah, well, hey, you know, he is, you know, that is Canada distilled into a 5'2", 200-pound package.
Anyway, we should close this out before I go on another whole tangent. But the way Canada...
Save it for the next one. Yeah,
I just got to say, like, the way Canada is portrayed, not only in the animated series, but in, like, the mainline Marvel comics, the way Canada is portrayed is fucking wild. We should get into it someday. But yeah, next up, Pokemon show. Should we do some Pokemons?
Yeah, let's do it.
And hopefully Wes will be back for that one. He hasn't been around for a couple recordings now. And then we'll start the rotation back up with a mini show. But that's
all right. Yeah, sounds good.
End of podcast.
All right, later.
All right, and I'm going to close it out as we often do with some games that are coming out next month, April 2024. That would be up first. We got Freedom Planet 2 coming out on April the 4th. That is a sequel to a game that came out way, way back on the Wii U. I'm not even sure if Freedom Planet 1 is available on Switch. Maybe it is. But it's kind of like this take on Sonic the Hedgehog, a little bit more action-based. The first one was than what you consider like the action platforming of Sonic the Hedgehog. Not really much action to it. In fact, if you get touched by anything, you lose all your rings. But neither here nor there. It looks all right, but I didn't like the first one all that much, so I'll be skipping that one. Kudzu, out on April the 5th, is a really interesting-looking game because it is a game that's also getting a cartridge release for the Game Boy. It is a game made for Game Boy hardware and is releasing digitally on the Switch for $5. And it looks a lot like a Zelda-inspired adventure game. Some of the sprites, like the alligator, look like they're, you know, paying really heavy homage to some of the character sprites in Link's Awakening. That is a really cool looking game. I stuck that one on my list. Not sure if I'm going to be able to get to it right away, but really, really cool to see this sort of retro 8-bit, like true 8-bit style game getting a release on the Switch, because a lot of times when these like pixel art retro style games are made, they are made with this sort of higher fidelity graphics, like what you think you remember 8-bit and 16-bit games looking like rather than what they actually look like. And this game, Kudzu, really does look like it was made on the Game Boy. Botany Manor is out on April the 9th. That is a game that was featured in a Nintendo Direct, and it's like a sort of mystery walking simulator game and a manor full of plants. I'm not really super interested in that one, but I felt like it was worth bringing it up because it was in a Nintendo Indie Direct at one point, or Indie Showcase. Moon Glow Bay is out on April the 11th. That's a cozy looking, like almost like Animal Crossing, sort of like dollhouse or simulator game in the kind of a higher fidelity sort of Minecraft art style. Very blocky. You can see like all the polygons and stuff, but it looks nice. It's a cute looking game. Grounded is out on April the 16th. We talked about that one on a previous show because that was in the most recent partner showcase. And it's cool. My buddy Sam actually has talked a lot about this game and all of the different things that you can do and the sort of different boss fights. And there's sort of like a general setup for the game. You're a guy who often shrinks himself down and turns the backyard into this empire. And you play the game as a sort of party of people. It's meant to be like a co-op experience. You play as a party of people who are accidentally shrunk down and then have to like survive and base build in this wilderness that is the backyard. You can see they're like the remnants of what the patriarch of this area has left behind. So that's a neat looking concept. I'm interested to see how it's going to run on Switch, because that is a game that is out for other the current gen Microsoft console. Planet of Lana is out on the same day, and this is a game that I was super excited when this was announced that it was coming over to Switch, because it's a sort of like a walking simulator, puzzle platformer sort of thing, but like super atmospheric, really whimsical, kind of like the way you would think of like Limbo or Inside, except it's, you know, a bit more like a bit less like a horror focused and more of like a sort of like fantasy aesthetic to it, and it's cool. Now that the cat is done climbing the couch, let's get back over to Eiyuden Chronicle. This is the Suikoden spiritual successor thing that was announced way, way back. It was Kickstarter coming to Switch. The physical release... No, she's not done climbing the couch. Maybe she's done now. Pets, am I right? The physical release for this game actually got delayed into May, and I'd really like to get this one physical. I'm not sure how quickly I'm going to be able to get to it. I do plan on buying it when it comes out, but it might be a situation where there are other games like Paper Mario, Thousand Year Door, that are coming out right next to it, so I don't know. Like, this might be a game that I play over the summer after I clear the deck of some other things. But really nice art style. I really like this sort of Suikoden style of RPG with all of these different playable characters and character classes, and that's all just like, it looks like it has like some cool party building mechanics with different characters. How they're interacting with other types of party members. So, it looks cool. Also, on the same day, April the 23rd, the Ninja Turtles arcade game Wrath of the Mutants is coming out. I mentioned this one because it's a Turtles game or a Turtles podcast, so it's worth bringing up because it exists. But I've watched some footage of this game. I've never played the arcade version. I've never seen it in any of the local arcades around here. I don't think it looks particularly great. I think it kind of looks a bit trashy. But who knows? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's great. But when you compare it to a lot of the other like Turtle arcade games, the original arcade game, Turtles in Time, those games hold up really, really well. And even like some like Shredder's Revenge, the other Turtles game that's currently available on Switch, that looks like it's so much more worth your time rather than this game. Maybe if there were a demo, I'd try it out, but I'm just not sure about this one by the way it looks. 2 days later, on the 25th, we're getting Saga Emerald Beyond. Every once in a while, I dabble in these Emerald games, these Saga games. But I don't know, like they hardly ever hit for me. There was one that was sort of a take on Saga called Legend of Legacy, and actually that one just got an HD remaster on Switch. And I played it back on 3DS, and I really liked that one. But otherwise, like, I played Saga Frontier recently. I guess, like, in the past several years, that one released on Switch. And that one, you know, it was all right, but it didn't really do it for me. This game has, like, some really, like, bombastic character designs, which is pretty cool. And it looks like it has some replayability because you can take control of all these different protagonists. So, you know, it might end up being a pretty cool game, but I don't know, I'm not running out to get that one either because of all these other games that are coming out. And I'm already planning on sticking Eiyuden Chronicle into the backlog, so I don't really want to stick more things into the backlog. One Crab's Treasure is one that me and Wes went on about when that was revealed or got the release date during the Nintendo Partner Direct a month back. It's a cool looking game, really fun and wacky sort of take on a action game where you have to do a lot of dodging and parrying. I think that one looks pretty cool. I'm hoping that Wes is able to pick that one up and report back on it because I'm interested in hearing more about that one. And then Braid Anniversary Edition, really cool get. Really nice that that one's coming to Switch because that was a game that has not been on Nintendo system yet, and it's one of the like earlier really important indie games from before like the big indie boom, before they got really, really big. This was like the grandfather, like this and like Cave Story are two of the older, like super successful indie games that really brought independent gaming into the forefront. So really cool get. It's a puzzle platformer where you can rewind time, and not only to like undo things that you did, but sometimes like setting something up and then rewinding time will not set it back to like perfect conditions to where it was in that point in time you rewound to. So some of the puzzling has like the sort of fourth dimensional thinking that you have to do in order to successfully pull off all the things that I want you to do. This is really, really cool. A 2D side-scrolling game. So it doesn't get super confusing. You're not dealing with all four dimensions. You're dealing with the two-dimensional space and the fourth-dimensional time. It's a really cool game. I only played it really briefly back in the day on PC, so I'm really looking forward to that one and getting into the rotation. But that is it. A really packed month. Actually, I thought April might end up being a little bit slower, but there's a lot of interesting things that are coming out that will be worth a grab. And still kind of plugging away at all the other things that me and Ryan were talking about before. So we don't really, God damn it, Kat, we don't really know too much about the Switch library beyond June. We know of like Fantasy Life I, and that's it in October. There are some things that are announced, like Professor Layton, Inazuma 11, which is now getting the beta test. I suspect that one probably isn't 2024. Deca Police, like all the level 5 stuff, and like Metroid. Other than that, like we don't know what's happening with the Switch. And this sort of thing happens quite often within the Switch's lifespan, where we get to a point and we all end up saying like we don't know what's happening after that. And outside of like one or two cases, the Switch has never disappointed in getting some cool software out in front of people to play. There hasn't really been very many droughts on the Switch. So I'm not super worried about what's going to happen. I am curious to see what the back half of the Switch's 2024 ends up looking like, because you know we just don't know much. And I was really expecting games like Paper Mario, Luigi's Mansion to sort of hit in like late summer, early fall to have some stuff available, but they felt good enough about those games to be releasing them in the first half of the year, so they must have something for the back half. So it'll be really exciting to see, really excited for what they're going to be showing in like June, July, to see what we're going to be playing for the rest of the year on Switch. But that'll do it for this podcast. Next up is going to be a Pokemon show. I'm hoping to do a quiz game. Don't tell Wes or Ryan, I'm going to surprise them with it. And then we'll start the rotation going. We'll keep it going with the mini show and the retro show, and then end the month of April with another official show. That's it. Till next time.